You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our SmartCast microlearning podcast series titled Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in NAMD and DME to Lower Treatment Burden and Improve Outcomes, an expansion of the Vision Relief No Eyes Left Behind initiative. This series is hosted by Dr. David Eichenbaum, a collaborative associate professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of South Florida Morsani College of Medicine, and Director of Research, Retina Vitreous Associates of Florida in St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's get started with today's episode.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. David Eichenbaum. I will be the host of today's podcast, Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in Neovascular Macular Degeneration and Diabetic Macular Edema to Lower Burden and Improve Outcomes, an expansion of the Vision Relief No Eyes Left Behind initiative. This is a four-part podcast talking about unmet needs in NAMD and DME treatment and how we can help address treatment burden. Today, I'm interviewing my good friend and esteemed professor, Dr. Vas Sada, professor of ophthalmology for the Doheny Eye Institute at the David Geffen School of Medicine at University of California, Los Angeles, California. In this episode, we will be discussing advances in anti-VEGF treatment to address barriers in the treatment of NAMD and DME. Hey, Vas, how are you today?
David, I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to join you. I look forward to our conversation.
It's a pleasure to have you. I always learn things when we talk and when you present, and I'm eager to learn from you today, as is the rest of the audience. So we're going to start by talking briefly about the barriers to adherence and the impact that has on vision outcomes in common retinal disease. We had a whole segment on this with our outstanding colleague Priya Vakaria as part of this series, but I'd like to review what your views are and your perspective is regarding barriers to adherence before we move on.
Yeah, thanks, David. So yeah, there's no question, obviously, anti-VEGF therapy has really transformed how we take care of patients or patients with these exudative maculopathies. You know, they have an expectation now that they could actually improve, which, you know, when I trained, certainly was not the case. You know, the clinical trials, the results are quite fabulous. But when we translate these to actual clinical practice, we find that that patients don't do quite as well. And a big part of it, of course, is these treatments aren't durable, that they have to be administered with a substantial frequency, you know, sometimes monthly for patients. And you can imagine for patients with AMD who are elderly, they have other comorbidities, they rely on sometimes family members for transportation. It's difficult for them to maintain that schedule. And similarly for patients with the diabetic macular edema, a lot of them are working age, but they again have other comorbidities and they get busy and they miss appointments. And we have real world data that says that the patients in the real world, their vision outcomes don't seem to be as good, and that does seem to correlate with the number of injections they get. So I think that's a pretty substantial barrier, despite the fact that these treatments themselves seem to be very effective.
As well put, it's an outstanding summary, and I agree that our peer-reviewed data shows a correlation between injection frequency, at least with our historically best-in-class injections, off-label bevacizumab, ranibizumab, and aflibercept 2 milligrams, and maintaining good visual results. In the clinical trials, as you stated, that registered ranibizumab and aflibercept 2 and validated our use of bevacizumab, the patients do well, but those are highly controlled environments with very frequent injections often. And in the real world, we strive to duplicate that, but we know it's challenging. So anti-VEGF therapy has revolutionized the care of these exudative macular diseases, as you mentioned. And when you were training, and I trained shortly after you, I recall the transition to intravitreal injections and how that was really turning the world around for these patients, and the expectations are high. We'd like to meet those expectations. And it's through 2023, 2024, what has been your anti-VEGF standard of care for common retinal disease?
Yeah, you know, the first generation anti-VEGF agents that you highlighted, David, with regards to 2 milligram aflibercept, ranibizumab, and repackaged bevacizumab, this really have been the standard for the last decade, really. And I think they continued to be. You know, it's a real question, though, and we'll get into that discussion as to whether they should be still in light of new therapies. But we have other realities, of course, right, that impact our clinical practice in terms of our payers. And one advantage of first generation therapies is they're generally are less expensive. We have also biosimilar agents for ranibizumab, for example. And so those are important considerations societally, as well as the fact, the realities of what patients can afford and what their insurers will cover. So even in this current era, I think for most clinicians, including in our own clinical practice, we tend to start with the first generation agents. As we've highlighted, they're highly effective. Although there are these challenges related to these barriers for patients adhering to the regimens that we'd like them to adhere to, but that's usually the starting point. But I envision that could change over time. One of the things with newer agents that we'll discuss is that they may give us greater durability, and so the overall net cost may actually be less in the long term, especially if we actually get better visual outcomes for patients because of better adherence. And that may eventually create a shift amongst payers and others, which may change actually the agent that we choose first. Because I'll be frank, if it was up to me and I didn't have any other restrictions, I might start with a second generation agent. The kind of thought process I often use, David, I think, you probably do something similar. I think about, if it was my mother, what would I do? And so that's why I say what I say. But again, we have to balance these considerations with the realities that our patients face.
Yes, it's the mother test, the family member test. And I agree with you. What would you put in your mother's eye or your own eye? And I do think many of us would choose, in the absence of any other barriers, some of the newer, more durable, potent agents. We got a taste of the newer agents. In October of 2019, we had the first second-generation agent approved, which is brolucizumab, the first agent that showed non-inferiority to Q8-week aflibercept with longer treatment intervals out to 12 weeks. It was a great drying agent, but it had an unacceptable safety profile with retinal vasculitis and intraocular inflammation in a small percentage of patients. But we're used to using drugs which really don't carry that risk with any significant incidents. So we abandoned that agent for the most part. Subsequent to that, we saw approval a little over 2 years ago of faricimab, and approval about a year ago of aflibercept 8 milligrams. And these agents, of course, in their registration trials showed good visual outcomes with durability out to 12, 16 weeks and beyond in the second year of the aflibercept 8 milligram registration series for NAMD and DME. And these agents have been incorporated into a lot of clinicians' treatment regimens, including mine. And I'm curious as to how you've incorporated faricimab and aflibercept 8 into your own treatment protocol for your patients.
Yeah, thanks, David. Yeah, very nicely summarized. And you're right, we don't use much brolucizumab now. It's such a great agent, such a potent anti-VEGF. Even before we had faricimab and now the quadruple dose of aflibercept, we were still using brolucizumab on occasion because, yes, there's this risk of inflammation, but a patient can lose vision from uncontrolled exudation as well. And so you have to balance those risks. But now we do have other choices, as you very nicely highlighted. And so I think they primarily are sort of second line agents in our practice, but there are some patients who may present with very severe exudation, where if we can get approval and coverage, we may consider using them first line. I think that they're a very good choice as first line agents. I think that one of the potential advantages, some say a theoretical advantage, but in my experience, it's proved to be a real advantage with faricimab, is that it does target multiple mechanisms and targeting both VEGF as well as angiopoietin 2. We're still understanding the role of angiopoietin 2 in patients. We know that it's elevated in patients with these various exudative maculopathies, vein occlusions, and diabetic retinopathy, as well as in macular degeneration. You know, how much do you need to suppress in every patient? We don't know yet, but certainly I think we've all had experience with patients who don't seem to be responding well to anti-VEGF monotherapy, and we use a bispecific agent like faricimab, and we see a resolution of exudation, prolongation of the interval. So I think having that in our toolkit has been super valuable. I do think that the aflibercept, the quadruple dose, is a value as well. In particular, I have to tell you that I found it to be of great value. So as I said, in my viewpoint, I think that that I would love to use these as first-line agents if there weren't other issues that we've already discussed. And I think that in the long term, they're going to prove because of their increased durability. And I do think that there is increased durability with both these agents. Sometimes people have asked, well, does that increased durability from the trials actually translate to clinical practice? And because of my treatment style, where I don't tolerate fluid and I like to have them dry, I may not get the same level of duration as in the trials. I definitely find that I get a longer duration in general for patients with these newer agents compared to our first generation agents.
So you made a lot of good points there. You said a very important thing at the very end, that your treatment style is to tolerate no fluid or close to no fluid. I have a very similar treatment style, and I have a very similar answer when people ask, are you getting 16 to 24 weeks in the second year of treatment with aflibercept 8? And the answer is probably not, because I tolerate no fluid, and the protocols for both the aflibercept 8 and faricimab and PTI, treat and extend style personalized treatment interval, did tolerate some fluid, probably more than you and I tolerate in our clinics. And I agree that the vast majority of use in my clinic is as a switch agent for the second generation drugs, just because I have so many patients who are on the first generation drugs, especially aflibercept 2 milligrams. And most of those patients would like to go longer. So when there's good access, I've been trying to convert those patients to second generation agents. I have had good fortune in starting patients on the second generation agents. And, you know, it's fun as a clinical trialist to take the stuff that you use in protocol and test drive it in the real world and see if you can duplicate the protocol driven results with similar treatment styles. And I've been doing some of that, but as you said, those patients just aren't as common, and there are multiple access barriers, step therapy requirements, preferred agent like double step requirements with some of our larger commercial and Medicare Advantage payers. But when there is access, it's nice to give the patients the best drug for them as quickly as possible. And in my opinion, for almost all my patients with common retinal disease, that's a second generation anti-VEGF agent.
And David, I wanted to add one thing, because I think you just said something very important about getting them dry. I mean, recently presented at the Retina Society meeting, just information, this is sort of a follow-up to a previous paper we had published on a post-hoc analysis of protocol I, but this is now using some of the newer clinical trial data. But just to make the point that patients who have residual fluid early on, those are the patients who tend to do poor later on. So I think it just points to, we want to get them dry and we want to keep them dry. And I think that, you know, in working in the best interest of our patients, we have to advocate, whether there's payer or other barriers, to try to get these next line agents, in case there's a problem with starting at first line. Again, as I said, I'd love for us to be able to start them all first line, to be able to go very quickly to a second line agent. The other thing I just wanted to add is that I really try to advocate for any patient that I can't get to every 12-week therapy on the first generation agents. That already is sort of a sign to me that I really need to try to push and advocate for them to be able to get coverage for these next generation agents. I think there's a real attractiveness to quarterly therapy. Most patients can handle that. And that's sort of a benchmark that I use, at least in my own clinical practice, for when I'm really trying to make the case to the insurance to make sure we have access. So I think we need to continue to advocate for that. Hopefully, the payers will start to realize that economically as well, it makes sense for them to allow us to utilize these agents early on.
Yeah, we are the patient's last advocates, if you will. The insurance company certainly isn't going to advocate for them, and the family doesn't have the know-how often. So we want to be able to be that advocate for the patient. And I did see that data at Retina Society, which was lovely and impressive and similar to data that we saw looking even back at the VIEW studies in NAMD, that patients who were drier earlier did better. So you got to increase your frequency or potency of treatment if your patients aren't dry early, whether it's DME or AMD. I agree with you. That's the way to improve their vision. Let's switch gears as we head down the back nine of this podcast. Port delivery system.
I think it is a very exciting option, David. I think most of us were quite disappointed when it had the issues with the septum dislodgement that led to the recall and led to the need for a redesign to allow some increased safety. I have to say that we use very little of this at UCLA. Probably we should be using it more, but the reality is that just around the time that we were thinking about using this, you know, we started to get these options of longer acting agents. So undergoing a surgical procedure and then having the potential for some other complications, weighing that against agents that may give us 12 weeks, the differential became smaller, quite honestly. I do think that it is a great option for patients who have travel issues and things of that sort. It gives them some measure of security. Having said that, one of the other challenges, though, still with this system, which may change now in this era of upcoming era of home OCT, is that most of us don't feel comfortable not seeing the patient for 6 months. So even if you get 6 months of delivery, which I don't know that, and again, that's going to happen in a percentage of patients. Some patients are going to have breakthrough and are going to need to have supplemental injections in that interval. But theoretically, it is to last 6 months. But the reality is that very few of us would ever consider letting a patient go out and not return for 6 months for fear that there could be some interval breakthrough activity. And so that ultimately undermines some of the benefits because then the patient is coming in or needing to come in. But having said that, you know, this treatment may see a real reemergence or resurgence, not just because it's now available again, after the FDA amended their decision after the redesign, but because of the fact that there may be a monitoring strategy that may give us more confidence to allow the patient to be seen over longer intervals.
It is the appropriate treatment, I think, for some patients who require a lot of shots and are poorly tolerant or who have travel issues, and they have to understand and be healthy enough to go for a minor surgery. I think it has very similar surgical risks to a cataract surgery. They have to understand the need for ongoing monitoring for post-operative complications. We know we have the black box for endophthalmitis risk with it that we have to understand and be able to mitigate. But this is a platform, and I think the concentrated ranibizumab is the first of hopefully other medications that will work well with that technology. Lastly, one more topic that I'd like to cover as we wrap up is, what are you excited about that's in the pipeline? Give me one or two products that you think are going to merit approval and would find a home in your clinic.
Yeah, I think there are two main products that are sort of, I think we can expect to be coming in the near future that will probably have an impact. One is are these tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Also intravitreally injected, but seem to provide some additional sustained release or sustained durability. You do seem to need to pair them with anti-VEGF. You might need to load with anti-VEGF to get the patient dry first, but then you inject one of these tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and the early data suggests that you can dramatically reduce the need for retreatment over the next several months. And, you know, I'm going to view that as a great security blanket for patients, you know, just in case somebody gets a hip fracture, that coming in, I know something's on board. And so, maybe a little easier to administer than putting in a port delivery system and the like. So I think that's pretty exciting. So we'll see how the pivotal trial results look like and see if they get approved, of course. And the other sort of, I guess, major area that we need to be on the lookout for is the prospect of gene therapy, producing anti-VEGF on board in the eye. There's several different programs ongoing about this prospect. I mean, obviously, one of the concerns is that you can't shut it off. That's one of the nice things about port delivery system or these TKIs is that that you can shut off the therapy. But for some patients, you know, it's very challenging for them to get in. And they just don't want to deal with any additional injections or treatments, it could be a very attractive approach. So gene therapy being a very durable sort of one and done kind of approach could play a role for a certain percentage of patients. So those are the things I think we need to be on the lookout for. And it's great that there's continued progress in our field.
I agree. Exciting times. Lots of products in late stage. We have two tyrosine kinase inhibitors, gene therapy intravitreally, gene therapy subretinally, earlier phase gene therapy suprachoroidally. We have additional VEGF modulation in phase 3. We've got a lot of exciting stuff in the pipeline. As always, it's an exciting thing to talk about with you and something that's a lot of fun to noodle on and think about what the future will hold. Well, thank you very much, Vas, for being with us here today. It's important to be able to understand the options at our disposal to better meet patients' needs and address barriers. I look forward to talking about treatment strategies to move patients from first-generation therapy in our final episode with Dr. Sumeet Sharma. We appreciate the time you took to discuss these issues with us today. I look forward to seeing you at Academy and at subsequent meetings, and it's always my pleasure to have you here on the radio. Thank you, Vas.
Thanks so much, David. A pleasure as always. Look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thank you for listening. Please join us again soon for the last episode in this series discussing strategies to reduce the treatment burden and improve outcomes for NAMD and DME. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide CME for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. A special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, who provided an independent medical education grant for this activity.